Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Everybody said coming into the game that it was going to suck. Remember that? Remember when everybody said that game would be so boring, that was not the matchup that anybody wanted? If that was your take yesterday, you can do one of two things right now. You can apologize, or you can just sit this one out. Because that was not just a good game, that was a great game. Two great coaches with great teams that battled their asses off. Oh, and about that allegedly ugly battle where the first team to 60 or even the first team to 50 was going to win? Virginia 85, Texas Tech 77, the highest scoring national title game in nearly two decades. That game was so good. One overtime did not feel like enough. I didn't want that game to end. But there were a bunch of times where it looked like it was over. For instance, when Virginia went into halftime with a last-second three and then came out on that 6-0 run to give them a nine-point lead. With the way Tony Bennett's crew defends, a nine-point lead may as well have been a 19-point lead. But even if it was a 19-point lead, that would not have mattered to Texas Tech. That's how good the Red Raiders are. That's how hard they go. They were down eight with less than 6 minutes to go. Everybody had given up on these guys. And they came back from the dead once again. In fact, they didn't just come back. They tied that game up. They had a three-point lead with less than 20 seconds left. It looked good until DeAndre Hunter did this.
Jerome will bring it up the floor. Jerome attacking, goes past Odiase, kicks right corner. Open three, DeAndre Hunter got it! Splashing it from the right corner to tie it at 68. 12.9 seconds to go.
Thanks to Westwood One for that. I mean, I said it yesterday. The matchup may not have had the household names like Zion, but there would be NBA players on the floor last night. And there were. NBA players and a man. DeAndre Hunter is a man. This guy's an alpha. He was a monster. 1 of 8 in the first half. But 22 points in the second half in OT. He had been struggling defensively. Check that, offensively, at times during the tournament. And then this guy breaks out in an enormous way. He breaks out when they needed it most. And it wasn't just about what he did on offense. He was a beast on defense, making every possession a battle for Jarrett Culver. This guy goes legend on the offensive end on the biggest stage in the sport. But to do that and then to lock up Culver on the other end makes it even more impressive. Culver is a likely lottery pick, and Hunter was all over this guy every single time. And yet, he still had the energy and the ice to make that shot. What shot? This one. Run it again.
Jerome will bring it up the floor. Jerome attacking, goes past Odiase, kicks right corner. Open three, DeAndre Hunter got it! Splashing it from the right corner to tie it at 68. 12.9 seconds to go.
This dude, I said it yesterday, Kyle Guy, he's got ice cubes in his veins. So does Hunter and Ty Jerome and Tony Bennett. In fact, everybody wearing Cavaliers gear is an assassin. Check out what these guys did in the last few games. I mean, that was not a one-off right there. Look at what they did in the last few games. Down by 3 against Purdue, 5 seconds left. Down by 4 against Auburn, 10 seconds left. Down by 3 against Texas Tech, 12 seconds left, and they won every single time. Winning one of those games would have been impressive. Winning all three is a joke. No wonder they were called a team of destiny. And they were called that by Chris Beard after the game. And he's right. This is the best way to describe a team that has done that against the likes of Purdue, Auburn, and Texas Tech. Do it once, it's amazing. Do it twice, it's freaky. But you do it three times, then it's destiny. That's not luck. That's not even skill, really. That's just who Virginia is. And it all starts with their head coach, Tony Bennett. I have not seen a guy that calm on the sideline in a national championship game since Jay Wright said, bang, as Nova's game winner fell. Tony Bennett looked like he was in a PTA meeting, not the NCAA title game. This dude was so calm throughout the entire thing, and so was his team. Even when it looked like it might be slipping away, they still clutched up. And why? Because last night really wasn't pressure. Kyle Guy needing to make 3 straight free throws against Auburn was not pressure because they had been through so much worse. In case you forgot, and I doubt that you did, this is the same team that lost to UMBC. they became the first one to lose to a 16 in tournament history. And they didn't just lose to UMBC. They got curb stomped by UMBC by 20. That was arguably one of the most humbling and humiliating losses in the history of college basketball, if not the history of all of sports. And however bad you think it was even worse than all that. As Laurel Bennett, Tony's wife, told Matt Norlander, quote, "The team got these death threats. They did take a police escort back to the hotel. They came in through a side door. A policeman went up with each one of the guys to their rooms. It was ridiculous. And it made it feel so much worse to them, I think," end quote. And that is ridiculous. And yes, it was so much worse. So how they respond? Quote, "By running to the roar." That was one of the mantras for the entire year. Run to the roar. Don't avoid what happened. Don't ignore it. Learn from it. Grow from it. Run to the roar. And that's how you get from one of the worst, most humiliating losses ever to one of the best moments ever, and you do it in a single year. That's how you get from the UMBC jokes to a moment like this.
6 seconds to go. Mooney up the floor. Three on the left wing. That is no good. Rebound pulled down by DeAndre Hunter. And they're going to dribble it out. From ruin to redemption, the Virginia Cavaliers are the 2019 NCAA National Champions. 85-77, Virginia wins its first men's basketball championship.
Like the word deserve gets thrown around quite a bit, but both these teams last night deserved a national championship. They were both that good, but it's nearly impossible to complain about Virginia winning it all. Remember when they trailed Gardner-Webb and they might repeat the worst kind of history? Remember when people were saying that Tony Bennett is a really nice guy and even a really good coach, but that his style does not work in the tournament? Yeah, well, it turns out his style does work in the tournament. They just made the best kind of history. Man, run to the roar. Run to a national championship. And the alleged worst title game ever turned out to be one of the best. Which is why I said yesterday, it may not be the matchup everybody wants. It might not be the matchup anybody wants, but it's a damn good matchup. And you know it's going to be a good game. And it sure as hell was. In fact, one of the best ever. Let's go to Matt Norlander. Matt, what's going on? How are you?
I'm just trying to keep it together, Jim. That's a guster pun. You might not get it, but I can drop another three or four in before we end this interview.
You should do that.
Pleasure to be with you, and more than happy and willing to step away from the security line here at rather busy Minneapolis Airport.
Nice job, Matt. Appreciate you. Thank you very much. All right, take me back, if you would, to last night's game before tip-off. It was all that doom and gloom about how crappy that game was going to be. Matt, what were your expectations going into the game?
Well, my expectations were an entertaining game, but I actually had Virginia winning 59-56. So what's incredible about what we saw was there was some discussion about the fact that, you know, there wasn't these mega stars. This wasn't the title game people would have expected a month ago. It didn't involve Duke or even Tennessee or Kentucky or North Carolina or any of these teams that were playing so well that, you know, a lot of people were rooting for. But the fact of the matter is they've rated as top five teams in college basketball. Virginia's rated as the best team in college basketball for most of the season. So given that Texas Tech's defense was historic and they still had good athletes, playmakers, oh, by the way, two top 10 picks, I expected it to be a good game, but even then it outstripped expectations. College basketball is on a great tear. Like, Jim, six of the past eight national title games have been good to great to downright epic, and I think last night qualifies as a top 10 championship game in the sports history.
I agree with you. Matt Norlander joining us. Now, part of the perception that it might not be a great game, Matt, as you point out, was that there weren't actual household names, but you did have at least two top 10 picks on the floor last night. Let me start with DeAndre Hunter. What do you make of the way he played on both ends?
Fantastic. You know, it's forgotten a little bit of how that game was early. It was 3-2 at the under media timeout, that first one, and Hunter was a little bit of a no-show again. But the way he stepped up, 27 points, a career high, I think he actually solidified. And you know, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but going into last night's game, you know, talk to NBA guys, between him or Culver, a 50-50, a coin flip, a toss-up, I do think that the way that he played throughout and on Culver is going to wind up with him getting picked before Culver in the upcoming draft. But it was awesome for him. And yet Kyle Guy gets the mop, the MOP. I mean, I voted for Hunter, but between him, Jerome, and Guy, that was the best game collectively that trio had played all season, Jim. And it came at the absolute time they needed it most there. And they you know, reinforced something I had been writing about and saying about for most of the season. That was the best trio in college basketball. It was better than any combination you want to give me of the Duke freshmen, three of those four guys. Jerome, Hunter, and Guy had been so reliable, so good all season, and they stepped up in a huge moment. They had, I think, all but five of Virginia's field goals overall last night. So the Hunter three, just another big-time moment. And, Jim, I just can't get over the fact that this Virginia championship has the absurd ending in Louisville, which I was there for the Elite Eight. Auburn, which is nearly absurd. And then, you know, they're down by three. Hunter hits the three with, what, 13 seconds to go? I can't remember a team ever needing that amount of fortuitousness, just being cosmically kissed the way Virginia did. And it makes it all the story all the more incredible, all the more special. And, frankly, you cannot find anything in the history of American sports that matches what Virginia's done year over year when you look at the UMBC loss and them coming back and winning 35 out of 38 games to get a title.
It's a really strong statement, and I can't say that I disagree with that. You've got plans to finally do some work on your car. Hood's up, you're ready to go, and uh-oh, you're missing a tool. It's one you don't have and, frankly, may never need ever again, but you need it right now. So what do? O'Reilly Auto Parts makes it easy with their loaner tool program. With more than 80 specialized loaner tools available, they're sure to have a tool in stock to help you get the job done right. Are you working on your steering? You may need a ball joint press or a tie rod separator. Two tools that you may never need ever again. Looking at your engine, you can borrow a valve spring or a piston ring compressor. Then you can return it. O'Reilly has tools for steering and suspension to fix brakes, tires, wheels, AC and cooling, even diagnostic tools so you know that you're on the right path. Just purchase the needed parts, put down a deposit on the loaner tool, return the tool in the original condition, and you will get a full refund. The deposit is the purchase price. It is that easy. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Matt Norlander is my guest. As an example, they had Matt one amazing moment after another in those last three games. As you point out, Purdue, Auburn, Texas Tech, moments where they could have folded but didn't. So based on your conversations with people around that program, people around Tony Bennett, how much of that goes back to last year and the loss to UMBC?
Plenty of it. I mean, real quick here, I had a chance to have some good sit-down conversations with Laurel Bennett, Tony's wife, in Louisville and then here in Minneapolis. And one thing that I don't think a lot of people realize was after the UMBC loss, you know, Tony had the great interview about the man in the arena and when you step in, anything can happen and all that. But, you know, the players, they were brought back to their team hotel. They were snuck in through a side door. There was a whole big circus with all that. And then they all were brought to their rooms individually by police officers, and it made the whole thing just seem all the worse. And so in the days and weeks after that, Tony and Laurel had a lot of conversations about what the loss was, how it would and would not affect them, how it wouldn't help define what Virginia was. Now, from the outside looking in, it always was going to. And in light of this victory, it makes the story even better, if that's somehow even possible. But the resolve that the players had, Kyle Guy's been open about his anxiety and some of the issues that he's had that stem from that loss. It has helped define a story that is too surreal for any movie and really too perfect for any documentary. You know those are coming, the documentaries, the books. The way the team handled everything this season, not just winning. Like, Jim, this was easily – I understand that Duke beat them twice, but every metric has said Virginia's the best team in college basketball for months. So to come back from that and then win the title the way they did, it is unreal. I believe it happened, but still on a certain level, man, like they should have been out after the Sweet 16, yet they somehow keep pushing through and pushing through and pushing through.
Matt Norlander joining us. And back to that point one last time, Matt. I mean, it's one thing to lose to a 16. It's one thing to suffer that kind of humiliation and pain, but they didn't just lose to a 16. They got hammered by a 16. And then as you point out, within 1 year, they bounced back to win the whole thing. What's that say about Tony Bennett as a leader?
I mean, so much. I said this last year when they lost. There was no coach that was better equipped mentally to handle that defeat in the entire sport than Tony Bennett. I mean, he was incredible with that, and he brought a ton of perspective throughout this tournament, because as you would expect, Jim, like every press conference, not everyone, but just about everyone in the tournament, you'd have a UMBC question of sorts. And a couple of times, the questions, frankly, they got a little melodramatic, just talking about, like, yeah, it's a historic loss, but Tony was like, listen, it's just a game. Like, there were times, his wife was telling me last year, where people were asking, like, you know, did you go into a dark room and just bury yourself away for 3 days? And it was like, no. Like, there are so many actual real-world problems, dire issues. Like, yeah, from a career perspective, it's a notorious and infamous loss. But we're going to be just fine. We're going to have our faith, and we're going to be – his faith in God really has played a major part in this. He's an extremely religious man, and actually I'm sure the cameras caught it last night. I obviously didn't see the broadcast, but when the game hit triple zeros after it when overtime ended, Bennett, he just kind of dropped his head. You know, he just stood there for a minute, sat there on the stool for a moment, and eventually his coach came over and hugged him, and I talked to him afterward about the game about that. He said, I was just giving thanks to the man upstairs. You know, I don't know why we had to go through what we went through, but I don't know if I deserve this, but I had to give thanks in that moment for something that to be a part of something so incredible. Very humble, very deserving. He's been regarded as a top 10 coach in college basketball for a few years now, but I don't think a title is necessary to validate that, but validate it will nonetheless. And Virginia's just one incredible story.
Right, and we could stop with all that garbage about how this guy's system does not work or he can't coach in the tournament because he proved that he can. One last thought, Matt, before I let you go. Various outlets are now reporting that Mick Cronin to UCLA is official and it's going to happen. How about a snap reaction? How do you feel about that fit for him and for them?
That, I think, is a good fit for him. UCLA fans are going to be frustrated. I'll get a quick thought on Mick, but as for the search has been a disaster. The opening came on New Year's Eve when they got rid of Alford, and then they had the interim situation, and they've had so many guys that have turned down the job, so much that has leaked out. It has not been handled well. Dan Guerrero, the athletic director, has tried to get big name after big name after big name, failed consistently. Mick Cronin, you know what? He's only one of six coaches to go to 9 straight NCAA tournaments. The problem that UCLA fans are going to have is that he's made 1-16 in that run, but he's not media averse. Coaches a really effective system. It's not like, by the way, it's not like Tony Bennett, but it is. He could be for UCLA to a certain degree what Bennett has been for Virginia. So I think that potential marriage could work well. And for Mick, you know, to leave Cincinnati is not going to be easy for him. It was going to take a job like UCLA. And I think there's good potential there, but I think he's also, it's unfair, but I think he's going to be behind the eight ball just a little bit because of how long the search took, because everyone knows that he wasn't the first, second, third, or fourth choice. We'll see how that winds up turning out, but that's, I believe, I'm talking off the top of my head here, Jim, but I think that's the last big job to open in college basketball, at least for now.
Matt Norlander, senior writer at CBS Sports, stepping out of security to join us on the way back home. Matt, really good to have you on. Thanks so much, and a great job as always.
Thank you, Jim. And remember, Guster, it's for lovers.
Know this. The quarterback formerly known as Johnny Manziel wants you to know something very, very important about him. Now it's John. Hey, John.
Hey, John.
That's right. 7 years after winning the Heisman, 4 years after taking his last NFL snap, and then after unsuccessful stints in the Spring League and the CFL and the AAF, now it's time for the rebrand. Comeback season is over. It's freaking pivot season, baby.
Pivot.
That's right. Pivots
pivot.
Making the pivot.
Pivot.
Pivots making the pivot to John.
Hey,
and
John.
Honestly, the only thing more ridiculous than dropping the Y is thinking that people will actually care. Hey, John.
Hey, John.
You do understand that just because you change your name, it does not change who you are. It does not change your past, right? It's kind of like just because you change the way you spell the word season does not change the fact that you cannot finish one in any league, much less the NFL. I mean, part of me doesn't want to get into this. Part of me does not want to get into this. My man got chucked from an entire football league and country. Mrs. John Football just scrubbed the dude from her Gram account. And now John seems to think that scrubbing the knee from the end of his name is going to be just what he needs, just what the NFL needs to give this guy another shot. Good luck with that. Listen, if we're being honest, dude changed his name a long, long time ago from Johnny Football to Johnny Idiot Face.
Johnny Idiot Face.
Then to Johnny Clipboard. And now essentially, it's Johnny freaking Suitcase. I mean, like, if the goal is collecting gear from different professional football leagues, then John is on the right track. If the goal is to play quarterback in the NFL, my man is so far off the pace that he's making his ex's half marathon look legit. Here's your bottom line, John. You couldn't rip a job from Jeremiah Masoli in Canada. Then you got run from an entire league, not the team, but the entire league for violating a contract. So when it comes time for teams to kick the tires on potential backup quarterbacks, I'm pretty sure they're going to be more concerned about that than the fact that you shortened your first name. Listen, what this guy did in college was electric. Absolutely electric. One of the most electric college players I've ever seen. But what he's done since then is straight depressing. Now, I'm not rooting against the guy. Far from it. Hell, what I want from this dude is to live a healthy, productive life. Do it as Johnny. Do it as John. Go by JP. Hell, cut that thing all the way down to J if you want. If that works for you, it works for me. But when it comes to playing quarterback, one thing's pretty obvious right now. John just isn't that good.
JJ, you're not that good!
The only thing that he's worse at right now than football is life. My man, focus on that. Because right now, life is kicking your ass. Put your phone down. Stop checking your online store. Stop changing your name. Just try to win today. Win today. That should be your only concern. Win today. Tyler Kepner is my guest. Tyler, great to have you back. How are you?
Good, Jim. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. It's a really interesting book. Now, let me argue first, Tyler, that the book's origins, you know, it has origins in your time growing up as a Phillies fan, watching Steve Carlton, which I'll get to in a second. But to prove just how legit a Phillies fan that you were back in the day, you and your mom were big Luis Aguayo fans. What was it about his game that you liked so much?
He used to come up big in the clutch, my mom always felt. She was like, you know, he was a guy you could rely on off the bench. He was a little guy. It looked like he was always getting the most out of his ability. You could play him all over the place. And it was kind of like a surprise if he was in the lineup. You know, you'd look and you'd say, oh, wow, it's Luis Aguayo today. You know, what's he going to do out there? But so, yeah, and he signed the autographs for my mom. To Mimi, love always Luis Aguayo. So I always appreciated that.
It's a great story. I love it. Tyler Kepner joining us. All right, so Philadelphia obviously made the big move of the offseason when they brought in Bryce Harper. It's only 9 games, but he's hitting .345. He's got 3 home runs. He's a top tenner in numerous categories. The season's barely started, but knowing that city and that fan base, what do you make of the start that Harper's gotten off to? And how important is it for him and for them?
Yeah, he has hit all the right notes with that town. You know, no prior connection really to Philadelphia. Got a lot of money, but he has completely embraced everything that city loves. I do know that his love of sports and sports history and the kind of passion that Philadelphia has, that is genuine. You could talk to him early in his career about some of his sports heroes, guys who we never even saw play, like Pete Rose and George Brett. You know, that kind of ethos is within him. But just, you know, even small details like the Philly Fanatic cleats that one day or meeting up with Allen Iverson, taking Carson Wentz to a Sixers game, and little things like not taking his number 34 to Philadelphia. You know, that was Roy Halladay's number, showing respect for Halladay, who, of course, is still so beloved in Philadelphia there. He is hitting all the right notes, man, with that town. They just want you to love him. And he seems to really love those fans there. It couldn't be off to a better start.
Tyler Kepner joins us. All right, so the book, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, is structured by devoting one chapter to each pitch and then talking to the pitchers who mastered it. This is where Steve Carlton comes back in, because you spoke with him about the slider. A lot of people know he's got a reputation for being not one of the chattiest guys in the media. So how was that conversation, and what did you learn?
Yeah, he didn't talk to the press anybody for years and years with the Phillies, I was able to get a line into him and kind of let him know I wanted to tell the history of the slider and couldn't really do it without him, and we talked for a long time. I mean, he learned from watching Bob Gibson when he was a young pitcher on the Cardinals how effective that pitch could be, but Gibson was always pitching through pain, and Carlton didn't want to have to deal with pain, so he became just a workout fanatic that carried him to. A really long career, but he first started throwing it in earnest in a Goodwill tour over in Japan, where he was facing Sadahara Oh, the great Japanese home run slugger, and Carlton was just sort of expecting these guys to kind of go through the motions and just play patty cake up there, as he told me, and then Sadahara Oh is hitting home runs off him, and he says, well, geez, I got to do something new to this guy, so he threw that slider, he aimed it right at his ribs, and it. Oh, went flying back, and the pitch went slicing over the plate for a strike, and he thought, I might have something here. And, of course, he went on to be the first pitcher with four Cy Youngs and went to the Hall of Fame.
All right, so what about his slider? What made it so special, and have you ever seen one that would compare?
Yeah, it had that, what they would call the two-plane break. Like, it would you know, he had the high fastball, and then he had the slider that would just slice, you know, in that diagonal across the plate there, too late for hitters to commit. I mean, you know, you see, that's why the slider is so hard, because it looks like the fastball for the longest. You want a really, really little bitty dot on it, almost an imperceptible dot. If you get a big one, then it starts spinning like a cement mixer, and guys know that they can telegraph it. But Carlton's, you couldn't really telegraph until it was too late. Like Willie Stargell said, like trying to drink coffee with a fork.
Tyler Kepner joining us. All right, so as long as we're talking about sliders and Philadelphia pitchers, you also talked to Brad Lidge, who used the slider in a couple of legendary moments with two completely different results. What did he tell you about the slider they threw to Albert Pujols in the 05 NLCS?
Well, that was what was so interesting about that. We have those two really memorable moments with the same pitch, and he said he had thrown a good one to Pujols earlier, and he tried to throw it even better. Like he just sort of tried to get out of that comfort zone and try to make it even nastier than it needed to be, and he just overdid it. His mechanics got, you know, out of whack, and he just left it right there in the middle, and Pujols obliterated it. You know, and then the moment comes in the 2008 World Series, man on second, a one-run game. Eric Hinsky comes up to the plate, and Hinsky had hit a fastball for a home run in the previous game. He had hit a fastball off Lidge off the wall the first time they ever encountered each other a few years earlier. So he was just going to go all sliders right there, and he struck him out on three pitches. Lidge had a slider that it could really break one of three ways, and it didn't have any kind of dot at all. And so, you know, hitters had no idea what was coming until it was too late. And even if they knew, they didn't know if it was going to break straight down or this way or that way. So, you know, and that's just one of those things, man. Like a guy like Brad Lidge, he's a first-round pick, but he didn't even throw the slider until he was already in the pro ball. You know, and that's the pitch that made him a star and made him a World Series champion. And he didn't even have it when he got in. And that's what I wanted to get into in the book, is how these guys learned their best pitches and just sort of the endless kind of creativity and innovation that comes with being a pitcher. If you're perceptive enough and open-minded enough to learn from teammates or coaches or just try anything, you might unlock a pitch that takes you to the Hall of Fame.
This book is called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. It's out right now. The author is Tyler Kepner. It's really an amazing read. Tyler, what about the fastball? Obviously, that's a different beast because there are a number of guys who had great, great fastballs. Who did you speak to about that, and what made their fastballs great?
Well, Nolan Ryan, you know, I talked to him for sure. Bob Gibson, J.R. Richard, who, you know, I also talked to about the slider, and he was just a fascinating guy to me. You know, his career cut short at age 30 with a stroke in 1980, right after starting the All-Star game. But he had a fastball and a fastball-slider combination that, you know, he is still held in such reverence by guys who didn't even strike out. Dusty Baker, you know, never struck out, but he struck out a ton against this guy. He was as revered and feared in his day as probably Randy Johnson was in his, or Sandy Koufax was in his. You know, and I try to get back to the beginnings of the fastball from, you know, who threw it the best early, Walter Johnson, Bob Feller. And that was, you know, that's the pitch, you know, everybody's got to have a fastball. But more than that, more than just the velocity, I wanted to get into guys who just believe in their fastball so much, even if it's not a super, you know, supercharged kind of radar gun pitch. Like Madison Bumgarner, I talked to him about the last out of the 14 World Series where he's facing Sal Perez, right? And a home run wins the World Series for Kansas City, but an out wins it for San Francisco. And why did he go all fastballs in that at-bat? He climbed the ladder on him. He didn't even try his other pitches. And we got into sort of, you know, some of those moments that we remember as fans, just trying to get inside the heads of these pitchers and why they picked the pitches that they did.
Tyler Kepner joining us, and there's a fascinating section also about knuckleball pitchers, who you refer to as Jedi Knights, because they've got a power that is hard to understand and to control. How do knuckleballers explain the knuckleball, and what's it mean to be a knuckleballer?
Well, every other pitch relies on spin, right? And the knuckleball, you don't want it to spin at all. You just want it to float and kind of let the air currents take it to wherever it wants to go. It's really frustrating to try to hit. It's really, really hard to try to pitch. You don't see anybody throwing it right now with Stephen Wright suspended at the moment. There's nobody in baseball besides Stephen Wright who throws it. So it's always kind of flirting with extinction. But because it's the one pitch that you can try on your way out the door. I think it's always going to have a place because it's still out there as a possibility. And it's what makes it so fun for fans, too, I think, is you and I can, anybody can watch a game and see Aroldis Chapman pitch and think there's no way I could ever in a million years throw 105 miles an hour. But maybe I could throw a knuckleball, you know, like maybe I could figure it out. And it's deceptive in that because it's the hardest pitch to throw, but anybody theoretically can do it.
So knowing all of that, is there a stronger brotherhood in sports than the brotherhood of knuckleballers?
I don't think so. And that was another thing, is that these guys, there's so few people walking the earth who know what it's like to throw a major league knuckleball. Their coaches can't really help them. Their catchers, at best, just roll with it and deal with it. Even the good ones, you know, they get beat up a lot back there. Their managers just need a lot of patience. Terry Francona said, just put your hands under your butt and keep them there because, you know, you got to trust that these guys have a lot to offer. But the brotherhood is powerful. Steve Sparks, the old knuckleballer for the Angels and Tigers, who now broadcasts for the Astros, was telling me about when he was into retirement, the Yankees, George Steinbrenner, called up his agent and said, anything, name your price. I want you to come and throw to our guys and give them some practice with knuckleballs before we face Tim Wakefield in the playoffs. And he's like, maybe I could have had $10,000. I could have had a suite at the Ritz or something. But I didn't want to do it because I didn't have a vested interest in that series, this is Steve Sparks saying, but he's like, I couldn't do that to Tim. I just felt like it would dishonor what we have as knuckleballers for me to take some easy cash from George Steinbrenner to so they could get a better look at scouting Tim Wakefield.
What a freaking Jedi. I love that. See, that's the brotherhood. That is the brotherhood.
Yeah,
this book is called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, which is out right now, and there's so much more to it. There's so many different pitches, and guys, we could have gotten into if we had more time. It's called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. You want to look for that. He's a national baseball writer for the New York Times. Tyler, great conversation. Good luck with that, and it's always good to have you on.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Anytime.
Clones. If we had to sum up what this show is all about, it comes down to one word: performance. Whether it's an important meeting, a business trip, or you're fighting the afternoon crash, sometimes you need that boost, but you want something different. You want an alternative to coffee or a sugary energy drink. I've discovered something that will help you take your game to the next level. It's called Dawn to Dusk. It's by Brickhouse Nutrition. Dawn to Dusk was designed to be a healthier, more effective alternative to typical energy supplements. And with as little caffeine as a single cup of coffee, Dawn to Dusk provides up to 10 hours of clean energy. It heightens focus. It improves your mood. It's amazing. And unlike coffee or energy drinks, there are no jitters or crash, only clean energy and focus with no calories or sugar. Here's what you want to do. Go to BrickHouseRome.com. BrickHouseRome.com. Get 15% off your first order with the offer code Rome. 100% satisfaction is guaranteed. You have nothing to lose, everything to gain. BrickHouseRome.com. Again, use it. I love it. BrickHouseRome.com. And if it killed me to have to do this yesterday, you can imagine how I feel about doing it right now. I mean, there's so many things going on in the world of sports, and yet here we were yesterday, on the day of the national title game, talking about Antonio Brown going full on some social media platform yet again. And that going full included taking a pointless run at Juju Smith-Schuster. A run so bad, so dumb, so tasteless that it had other pros who don't play with either one of them weighing in on it. That bad. You know, guys that it did not concern at all, swerving way out of their lane to take a run back at AB. But the good news is, Antonio Brown learned from the public thrashing that his reputation took after that tweet. He put his phone down. He has not looked back. He has not thought about it since. He's moved on. Oh, excuse me.
Oh, excuse me. My bad.
No, what he did was he immediately jumped right back onto Instagram and he posted this. It's a screenshot of a direct message, a DM from Juju Smith-Schuster when Juju was still in college. The message reads, and I quote, "What's up, AB? I'm a receiver at the University of Southern California. I appreciate all your work. You're a great man. on and off the field. Do you have any tips that can help take my game to the next level? Thanks, man. End quote. All right, a couple of quick things to unpack here. Number one, I'm not a fan of publicly posting a private message at all. That was a direct message that was sent to Brown that was not for public consumption. If Juju Smith-Schuster wanted to make that public, he would have made it public in the first place. So to me, posting a direct message like that is bullcrap. And then there's the second part. The second part, and that part being, what the hell is the point of that? The hell is that? You posted a message from a then college student who politely and respectfully was asking you for advice. Oh, roasted! What a sick burn. Damn, AB. You lit that chump up. I mean, first off, I'm not even sure at this point what's more bizarre. Antonio Brown's obsession with Juju Smith-Schuster, or the fact that he thought that that message would actually be a winning message. The outside perception is that Juju has always been really respectful of Antonio. So then Antonio flips that on its head by posting a DM of Juju being very respectful of Antonio. In other words, I really do not see this guy working there. Juju is so in AB's head at this point that he's paying rent and utilities. This whole thing has jacked with AB's mind so much that it's confusing to see what he's doing and where he's going. Like, what is he doing with this? Oh, I got cracked on by everybody on Twitter for bringing up the fact that Juju fumbled in a game last year. Yeah, well, how about this bomb I'm about to drop? There was this time where he was a kid in college and he was extremely respectful to me. Yeah, how's that taste, you all? Yeah, that's what I thought. Who's the bad guy now?
Tell me how my ass tastes.
And even better is the fact that AB posted that polite message from a college kid and then stood back to admire his work. He enclosed a mic emoji in the caption, you know, like a mic drop. Like, look at this fool being polite and respectful to me. Boom! I'm out of here. Shut it down. Let's go home.
Shut it down. Let's go home.
Hey, Juju, tell me how your politeness tastes.
Tell me how my ass tastes.
Like, I don't even get it. What are you doing with that? What's next? Posting a video of Juju helping an old lady across the street? Screenshotting a text of him complimenting you on having a good game? Hey, yo, everybody, check out this clip of Juju being nice to the fans and signing autographs. Roasted! I mean, my man AB is so turned around right now, he doesn't know what's up from what's down. He's done to himself what he does to DBs. I mean, he's jacked up. Did he really think that posting a message of Juju being nice to him would be a mic drop moment? I mean, I can't figure this out. But maybe the thinking inside of AB's head is posting this proves that he's the alpha because Juju came to him for advice. Right. He came to you for advice when he was in college. That's what college kids do. And he did so in a really polite and respectful way. And then you out him. You out him for what? Being polite. How's that work? Once again, sickest burn ever. Man, I've said it before. I'm going to say it again right now. Antonio Brown needs to put down the phone. That's obviously not happening. No, somebody needs to do this for him. Somebody needs to step in. Somebody in his corner needs to throw the towel into the center of the ring. Because right now, this guy is a fighter who's out on his feet just blindly throwing punches. And the only time he's connecting is when he hits himself. I'm not even sure what fight he's in right now. I don't know who or what Antonio Brown is fighting for. He got exactly what he wanted. He's out of Pittsburgh. He has a new contract, a new situation, a new quarterback. I don't know what this guy's fighting. or who he's fighting. I just know that Antonio Brown is losing, and he's not stopping. This has always been a big AB house. Somebody step in and stop this fight. Somebody's got to stop this guy. Please. AB, stop. Hey, check this out. Check out this video I have of Juju blocking downfield for his running back. Roasted! Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you want to see a loser? How about this loser playing in week 17? Oh! Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. AB, man, stop. Please. Please. I don't want to have to do that. Believe me, that hurts you more than it hurts me, but it does hurt me. Man, stop. Greg Berhalter joins me in studio. Greg, it is great to have you on the show. How are you?
Really good, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bring me up to date. So I know it's been a whirlwind. You've got a lot of things going on. How is your life? How is the family? What's it been like?
So it's been great. You know, if I take you back from December when this whole thing started, you know, since then it's just been a lot of travel, a lot of conversations, trying to get, you know, an idea of the landscape, of the player pool, of some past experiences, and just plotting a course for how we're going to move forward with the team.
Okay, so what about that pool? What do you make of the quality of players that you have in the pool?
So I think the first thing is that, you know, I really like this, the young, talented players that we have. You know, we have some really young players with a really high potential. When you talk about a Tyler Adams playing in Germany, Weston McKennie in Germany, Christian Pulisic in Germany, three very talented players. But then when you look in Major League Soccer, we're starting to see this younger group starting to emerge. You know, there's players from FC Dallas, players from Philadelphia. And that's, you know, that's really interesting. As a coach, that's what gets you excited.
All right, Greg Berhalter in studio. If you've got a question or a comment for him, once again, the phone number is toll-free in the U.S. and in Canada, 1-800-636-8686. You mentioned Tyler Adams. There's a lot of buzz around Tyler Adams. It's well-deserved because he's made a name for himself in the U.S. already, but as you mentioned, he goes to Germany, and he's having an impact immediately. I know you don't want to hype him too much, but when you look at him and his game at just age 20, what kind of thoughts do you have?
So I think, you know, if you relate it to other sports, he's a guy that it just brings a ton of energy. He has a real dynamic in his game, very explosive. He can cover a lot of ground. And, you know, he has a skill set that makes him very versatile. So you can put him on, you can put him in a number of positions on the field and he can still be effective.
Right. So in the past, among fans, there's always been this rush to get hyped on the next big thing, right? The next young player. I want to avoid doing that, but he is one of three 20-year-olds who play in Germany, and they're already key figures on the national team. You're somebody who played in Germany, so how valuable is that experience?
So I think when what you have in Germany is, you know, packed stadiums, you have a high level of pressure, you have a very dynamic game, fast-paced game, and a very precise attacking game. So I think what it does is it prepares the players, you know, to play at a different speed. So when we get guys back that are playing in Germany, we see that they can adapt very quickly to a high level of speed in a game.
All right, so you just finished up the international window with a win over Ecuador and a draw with Chile. From the outside, at least from the outside, it would seem like those matches feel significant because of the quality of the opponent and the fact that you had a full pool of players, but you're on the inside. So how significant do those matches feel to you?
You know, I told the group before we got together that this will be the most challenging two games we'll have together as a group. And the reason why is because we literally had zero preparation time. So if you think about introducing 11 new players into the pool and then having to perform after just only one training session, it was challenging. But the guys did great. And I think what we did is we set the foundation of how we're going to build moving forward. And I think that from that experience itself, it was valuable.
Yeah, so what do you do about that? If you have no time to get ready, you want to implement this change, right? Yeah. In style of play, in culture, but you do not want to overload them with information.
Exactly.
How much do you give them? How do you make that work?
So, you have to stay disciplined as a coach because your instinct is to overload them. And, you know, admittedly, at times we've done that. But sometimes you just have to pull back and say, okay, we'll give you, basic information. We'll stick to the principles of how we want them to play. And then... and then show them stuff, show them video, and then hope that enough is absorbed that they can have a performance on the field that we're looking for.
We're talking soccer. The U.S. men's national head coach, Greg Berhalter, is joining me in studio here in Southern California. Now, Chile is an elite team, and they play a pressing style that's been a problem for U.S. teams in the past because of the challenge of playing out of pressure. What do you make of how your team responded to that challenge?
You know, I thought it was mixed, to be honest. Okay. There were times when it was really good, and there were times when it could have been better. But that's what we expected. And I think what we learned from that game is I think we've gained confidence that we can do it. And if we're prepared, and if we believe in it, and if we're brave enough on the field, we can do it.
That's interesting. Brave enough on the field. I like that phrase, because part of what we're talking about here is a schematic change in terms of maybe not dropping back, waiting to counterattack. But how much of it's a change in attitude, right? In being brave on the field and wanting to disorganize the opponent. How much of that is about being aggressive and bold and just a mindset?
A lot of it. A lot of it. A lot of it is mental. It's believing that you can do it. I think it's believing in the structure, that the structure can help you disorganize the opponent. And then, you know, committing to actually doing it. And what we've seen, Jim, is that, you know, we'll actually train this and the players get stressed when we're training it. And because, you know, it's uncomfortable. If you think about, you know, if you start the play from your own goalkeeper and you make a mistake, guess what? You can get punished very quickly. So it's a very stressful exercise, and it's just getting the guys used to it and saying, okay, listen, you can play here the same way you can play in other parts of the field. Just be calm, stick to the structure, and stick to the principles.
In other words, get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Greg Berhalter joining me in studio. He is the coach of the U.S. men's national team back here in California. So one of the things you and I have talked about each time is that style of play. The style of play that you're looking for, four matches in, how close is that style to what you are looking for?
We're getting there. You know, it is going to be a process, and we have to understand that. And, you know, as coaches, we have to understand that. But we're certainly getting there. I think we made positive steps in January camp, and then now with the introduction of a new group of the player pool, we've made more progress in the last camp, and we're going to continue to build on that in the Gold Cup.
We're talking to Greg Berhalter. We're going to talk about the Gold Cup in a minute. You know, one of the things that's getting a lot of attention among U.S. fans is the arrival of a shape and a function that seems to have a bit of Manchester City influence in the way the right fullback joins the midfield when you have possession. So is that perception correct? And what do you like about that approach?
I think similar to Manchester City, what we're trying to do is, take advantage of our positions on the field to unbalance the opponent. So all it is moving, you know, a player into a different area of the field that gives us balance, but also gives us a numerical advantage to be able to start our attacks. So Manchester City, you know, I believe has very similar principles. I think they have a, you know, high level player to execute it at a different level, but you know, I found that our guys are open to it and really wanting to learn and wanting to play a game like this.
You know, Greg, I got to be straight. Like, you and I back in the day would sit together and watch our kids play Little League Baseball. And you and I would talk sports at that time. And I always felt that you were extremely focused, extremely disciplined. You had a plan. You worked that plan. So I'm not at all surprised that you're in the position that you're in right now. But I'm kind of blown away by the magnitude of this job that you have and how quickly you got there. And then I look at the whole thing and now I hear people talking about the Berhalter system, the Berhalter approach as it relates to a U.S. national team. I mean, how do you feel about this whole thing? Do you take a step back and you have to take a breath and say, damn, I really am the coach of the U.S. men's national team? Or does this all feel very normal to you and like the normal process of things?
You know, Jim, I think it's similar to you. What you do is you put your head down and you work every single day. And you know that if you're working at a good level, good things will come. But I didn't sit, you know, I never, you know, when we were watching those Little League games, I never said to you, hey, I'm going to be the coach of the national team one day. All I did was just work hard. And, you know, you believe in your talent. And it comes through, mostly is preparation.
Right, so you can relate to this because you are a big sports fan and you and I would sit and talk about whatever was going on at that time. Every coach and every manager that I have on this show these days talks about two things, culture and relationship with their players. Now you have the additional challenge of trying to develop that culture and relationships in short bursts in camp, but you've been very intentional about that and it's kind of taken on life of its own, kind of like those crossword battles in January. How would you describe then the culture and the identity of the men's national team right now?
You know, it's fun trying to build the culture of the team. And I think the first thing is that, you know, when we talk about our cultural identity, you know, it's very easy because we're representing our country. We have such a fantastic country. It's so easy to, you know, to tie into, you know, the elements of who we are as a nation and get the guys behind it. But the other thing is, you know, when you're doing these team building events, whether, you know, we're doing some exercises with the military, we're doing NASA exercises, and, you know, it's a great learning experience for us, but it really brings the guys together and forms a common bond. I think men tend to bond with experiences. And, you know, by us giving them more experiences, you see the team coming together.
So those experiences, those things where they come together and they bond off of the pitch, off of the field, how does that then translate and bring them together on the field?
You know, a lot, when we're, for example, we're listening to this astronaut talk, and the guy was a helicopter pilot in Afghanistan. And after that, he retired and he's delivering babies. He became a medical doctor, and now he's preparing for, you know, a mission to space. And it's going to take 6 years. And this guy's talking, and like, the guys really can translate how, you know, the process doesn't happen overnight. And it's about, you know, bringing your lunch pail to work every single day. So I think, you know, these experiences off the field will tie onto what we do on the field, because the guys will have each other's back.
The U.S. men's national coach, Greg Berhalter, joining me in studio for a few more moments. Talking soccer, having a great time doing it. Listen, there's one more thing about this that's really important to note. For a lot of these guys, you're their fourth national team coach in 2 years. Tim Ream said, quote of you, quote, "It's a breath of fresh air, because before it was, let's qualify by any means necessary, chop and changing, switching things up, whatever it took. He's very focused on playing a certain way and sticking to it," end quote. I mean, you played for different guys in different situations. How important is that stability and identity?
I think it's important. I mean, I think in any walk of life, all people want is clear expectations. And if you outlay it clearly and you, you know, you tell them what we're looking for, I think it's easier to perform at a high level.
Hmm. You mentioned the Gold Cup. It's coming up in June. So how do you approach your time between now and the next camp?
So we've been watching all of our players all across the world. We've been watching them live and on tape. This week in particular, all the coaches are spread out across the United States, visiting other MLS clubs, getting to know the coaching staff, working with our players, talking to our players, and watching more live games. You know, we're going to transition in the next couple of weeks to starting. We'll find out our group on Wednesday. And then we'll start scouting the opponent, and we'll go pretty deeply into that. Then we'll know, you know, all the opponents, the last five games of the opponent, and really understand what they're trying to do. And then we prepare to, you know, to try to win a competition. And that's the exciting part of what we do when you get to compete.
So you feel like you're right where you thought you'd be, or might you even be a little bit ahead of schedule?
You know, I'm always concerned. I always want more. So I think, you know, we're never really happy. We always want to keep going. I think we've made progress, but we want to keep performing.
Yeah, Greg, also before you go, I mentioned in the open that you're the first U.S. men's national team head coach to have played for the U.S. in a World Cup. How much is that experience helping you right now?
It helps. You know, I understand that there's a tremendous amount of pride that comes with putting on a United States jersey, but then also knowing what the international competition is and how the games unfold and you know, the level of intensity and pressure that the players are going through. I think it certainly helps.
All right, so you're a Carolina guy. You went to North Carolina. Your wife went to North Carolina. Everybody wanted to see a North Carolina Duke NCAA title game in basketball. Did you watch the championship game last night?
I did. I saw it from afar at a restaurant, and, you know, Carolina broke my bracket because I had them winning it. I actually had them playing Duke in the final. Have they ever played each other in the NCAA tournament? Do you know that?
No, they have not.
They haven't, right?
Not in the final. Not in the final. Not in the final. Right.
Yeah, so that would have been great.
Would have been great. Didn't happen. What was it like to play college soccer there?
You know, North Carolina is an unbelievable sports university. All the sports were at a high level, and, you know, it's a great college town. You know, you told me Jake's going to Wisconsin, so he's going to be in the college town as well. And, you know, that's the experience that makes college just great for student-athletes.
Yeah, but Tobacco Hill, what's it like having those two, I mean, beautiful academic institutions with the athletic background and history they have that close together?
It's great. It is great. Then you have NC State right down the road as well. And it, you know, I think it adds to the competition, and you feel, you know, Duke athletes will come onto Franklin Street and want to hang out, and they, you know, we wouldn't be too cool with that. And it was great.
Good night, now.